Good day, everyone, and welcome to the MedKie All Physician Call on COVID-19. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Gene Ransom. Please go ahead, sir.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks an awful lot for coming on. I appreciate you taking time from your busy weekend to get an update on the COVID-19 situation. MedKie has been focused on this issue since it first became apparent it was going to be a public health issue. And I want to thank Dr. Richard Bruno, Chair of our Public Health Committee, and Dr. Catherine O'Keefe, Chair of our Disaster Preparedness Committee, who've been taking lead on this issue for months now. I'd also like to thank Dr. Howard Half from the Maryland Health Department, current Executive Director of the Maryland Primary Care Program, to come on and speak tonight to talk about the state efforts with regards to this very important issue. I'd be remiss if I didn't say something about the help that Teresa Healy Conway, one of our County Medical Society execs, who's been key not only in staffing the Public Health Committee, but also in getting the logistics together with regards to this call. COVID-19 obviously represents a major public health emergency for the United States and the state of Maryland, and we are hoping to be a major part of the solution as we move forward with regards to this. Dr. Haft will be doing a brief presentation, and we will not take questions during that. And then after Dr. Haft's presentation, we will open it up for any questions that you have. So again, thank you, Dr. Haft and Dr. Bruno, for agreeing to speak to us tonight and give us an update on COVID-19. And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Richard Bruno, Chair of MedKie's Public Health Committee.
Thanks a lot, Gene. I really appreciate it, and thanks for pulling this together. Thank you, everybody, for being on tonight. I think it's a very important topic, and I'm glad we're able to discuss it, the physicians of the state. So wanted to give you also a brief plug for the MedKie has a COVID coronavirus resource center directly on our website. So if you go to medkie.org, you can see our coronavirus resource center, which has a list of helpful resources. We're updating it all the time. With different links to ongoing and updated data as it becomes available, especially from the state of Maryland and CDC. So please use that as a resource if you like. We also have a CME on there. You can get an hour's worth of CME by listening through one of our CME understanding and addressing the global spread of the COVID-19 infection, a clinician's guide. So if you're interested in gaining CME from that, it also has updated information about the virus and how we're triaging and testing and treating it at the moment. I'll turn it over to Dr. Howard Haft, who is here. He went to medical school at Penn State, graduated from residency at Brown, has a Master's of Public Health and Tropical Medicine from Tulane, and he's board certified in internal and emergency medicine. So we're very lucky to have him on tonight representing the State Department of Health. And thank you very much, Dr. Haft.
Thank you, Dr. Bruno, and thank you, Gene, and the others who put this call together. And thank you, my friends and colleagues, for joining us this evening. My purpose this evening is to provide you with as much timely information as possible about this unique global pandemic. I hope to tell you what we know now, what we don't know, things that we want you to do currently, and then give you as many points of reference for continuing to get updated information as this evolves over the next several days, weeks, and hopefully not longer than that. So let me begin by doing some level setting. Probably everyone here has heard a number of things about the coronavirus, and some of this may be very much repetitive, but I want to make sure that in the broad audience that we're all consistent in terms of our understanding. And first, coronavirus is a family of viruses that causes diseases in animals and humans, including the common cold. So many people have said it's just like a cold. It's the same kind of virus as a cold, but it clearly is different from the cold and clearly different from the flu. It's much more closely related to conditions that we've seen from previous coronaviruses, such as SARS and MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. They've had different courses, and quite likely this course for this particular coronavirus will be unique to this virus also. Very hard to predict what the future course will be. I'm certain that you've heard many things about the fact that it will get better as soon as it gets warm, that it'll come back and circulate the globe and be a seasonal epidemic. None of that is in fact known. Those are speculations. This is in fact a novel virus that we have not dealt with in human beings before. We do know that the transmission is spread from person to person, primarily through respiratory droplets, coughs, and sneezes, but it can also be picked up from surfaces. There's no clear science on how long it exists on surfaces, but clearly surface cleaning is part of the way that we prevent this disease from spreading. It has an incubation period of anywhere from 2 to 14 days based on our current knowledge. And I will many times say our current knowledge is limited based on what we know only over the last several months. And over time, we will learn a lot more about this particular disease. The average incubation period is 5 days. It appears that people may be able to transmit the virus either if they're asymptomatic or in early symptomatic stages. The symptoms, when they appear, are typically fever, cough, and shortness of breath. The severe symptoms that people get from this are pneumonia and respiratory failure, although we are aware from the experience in China, now in Italy and other places, that other organ failures have occurred in people, patients who have been severely affected with cardiomyopathy or renal failure or multi-organ system failure. But most typically, it's been pneumonia and respiratory failure. It was first identified in Asia, but now is a global virus. The first cases that we identified in Maryland were on March 5th of this year. This is a disease that has no preference for any ethnic or racial group, and no group is at greater risk than others, to our knowledge, for developing COVID-19. All age groups can be affected, although clearly older people and those with compromised immune systems or those who have significant chronic diseases, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, end-stage renal disease, congestive heart failure, and other conditions are much, much more likely to have serious consequences. In fact, the vast majority of deaths from this disease have occurred in those individuals and individuals 60 and over. Under 60, the death rate is significantly lower, and over 85, the death rate is very significantly higher. As of yesterday, there were 26 cases in Maryland. Most of those cases were travel-related, but we do now see community transmission. And with the onset of community transmission, and even prior to that, Governor Hogan established an expert coronavirus response team that is meeting daily to help provide expert advice to the state on how to mitigate this pandemic. In addition to that, the Maryland Emergency Management Agency, MEMA, is having daily coordinating calls with all members of the state government. In addition, the Maryland Department of Health has additionally daily calls and is really an all hands on deck event for the Department of Health and for the state. In my experience in state government, I have truly never seen a response as aggressive and as coordinated and focused as this response. And it's my hope that gives some comfort. The governor has, as you probably all have heard by now, also been aggressive, more aggressive than many other states, in taking actions to mitigate community transmission. He issued 5 executive orders. It did things such as closing schools, closing the cruise ship ports, daycare centers, and other sorts of activities that are all intended to mitigate this epidemic. And as I'm sure you're well aware, we're in a phase where mitigation can actually save lives by reducing the rate of transmission right now of this disease. We can save particularly those most vulnerable people from experiencing unnecessary exposure to this disease. One of the significant barriers to diagnosing individuals was the testing issue. I think you've seen probably across the country, the testing has been a challenge. It's been a challenge because of the limited supplies. It's been a challenge because of only recently would commercial labs have the ability to take samples, and also challenging in that the availability of personal protective equipment to protect individuals who are obtaining samples has also been limited. That has been addressed also aggressively, and in the next days, you will see a rapid increase in testing ability, particularly in those drive-through testing sites that are being established across the state. And there'll be more information coming out on that on a daily basis. Perhaps you've already noted in some of the news clips and press releases that hospitals and local health departments are working aggressively to establish those, to support those places as community providers who don't have sufficient PPE, personal protective equipment, to safely gather those samples. So what are the roles of our providers, our primary care providers, our specialists, our hospital providers in this situation? But those roles are clearly the same roles that we always have. It's to protect and treat all of the patients that we serve in Maryland. So at this particular time, prevention and treatment is top of mind. Also top of mind for us now should be protecting the health and safety of ourselves and our staff. This will be an episode that will last clearly more than a few days and perhaps more than a few weeks and perhaps even longer than that. And this is a time where we need to make sure that we have adequate healthcare staff to continue to provide treatment and prevention for the people we serve in Maryland. In that regard, making sure that we use the best possible hygiene and safety precautions as we're caring for patients and even as we're screening patients. And those guidelines are all available both on the Maryland Department of Health website. They've been made available through clinician letters that have gone out to 45,000 clinicians, and also available and updated frequently on the CDC, the Center for Disease Control website. I urge you to pay particular attention to the safety of your staff, yourselves, and also your patients who are being seen in your offices. Also, communication is a key role of what we will be doing as providers of healthcare in this setting, communicating with each other as we're doing now, but also very clearly communicating with our patients to let them know what they should do in these circumstances. All of the things that have been widely broadcast to them in terms of hand washing and avoiding crowds and staying home if you're sick, but also communicating to our patients that wherever possible, if they are potentially patients with COVID-19, that they should be contacting us in advance before coming into the office and potentially spreading the contagion. Also, letting them know that if they do come into the offices and it's necessary to do that, that their visit should be done in a special way so that they're given a mask and quickly roomed in a room with a door to protect any spread, and that staff understand that that's necessary and done consistently. Those kinds of communications, whether it's to our patients or to our staff, are really critical at this time. Also, it's really important for us to be able to do proactive outreach to our patients. Doing proactive outreach, particularly to the patients who are high risk, those who have serious chronic diseases, the elderly, those who have end-stage renal disease for a nephrologist, et cetera, to give them good guidance about how best to protect themselves, and particularly to make sure that they have adequate supplies of their medications, that they can stay in touch with their care managers or providers, whoever is responsible for them, letting them know in terms of their own personal protection that if they're staying at home, that they should have their visitors washing their hands, keeping a safe social distance, and all of those things that will help protect those most vulnerable patients. And then in regard to testing, we do have a special role, but that role is limited to identifying those individuals who should be tested. And clearly, we'll talk about this in a second, it's not everyone that needs a test. We would soon overwhelm the ability to do tests for those who need them if we tested everyone. So testing is done at the discretion of the providers, of the physicians or the PAs or nurse practitioners who are caring for the patients. And it should be done in consistently with the CDC guidelines. Those guidelines allow for clinical judgment, and clinical judgment is extremely important in these cases. Clearly, clinical judgment will lean toward those who are most vulnerable, those who have appropriate symptoms, and those who need to be tested in order to determine what setting they'll be cared for in. Staying up to date is also critically important in this situation for providers, because we will have a situation that will change on a very rapid basis. So what are the CDC guidelines for evaluation? Number one, clinicians should use their judgment and the applicable CDC guidelines to determine if a patient has signs and symptoms compatible with COVID-19 before sending them to be tested. So those signs and symptoms are fever, and that could be subjective. A patient can say, I feel feverish. In fact, we've seen patients who don't have a fever, but do have the other symptoms of cough and respiratory distress. The decisions are also based on the epidemiology. Right now, we do have community spread, so anyone who has the symptoms would be potentially a candidate for testing. Now, certainly not everyone who has symptoms, particularly the young and healthy, may not need to be tested. They can be self-quarantined at home with the appropriate guidance and followed clinically, and a decision about testing can be deferred for those individuals. Most of those individuals, most of the young and healthy, this will be a self-limiting disease. Most of the patients with COVID-19 have developed the symptoms, and so that is of cough and difficulty breathing. So that is really the key for, in addition to your clinical judgment, for guiding who should be tested. When we test individuals, we should also be looking for other respiratory symptoms, because other viruses and flu and other conditions can also mimic COVID-19. And if a COVID-19 test is negative, you may want to understand what is driving the patient's condition. There is no particular medication to treat this condition. Over-the-counter medications to support fever, fluids, and those sorts of non-prescribed medications and symptomatic support are what we have available. Additional to that, we can also provide a great deal of comfort to our patients by providing continual, as frequently as needed, telephonic or telemedicine support. Seriously ill patients, however, or those who appear to be deteriorating, must be hospitalized. The rate, the rapidity in which respiratory failure occurs is undetermined, but your good clinical judgment, if patients have unabating fever or continuing to decline clinically, that is the time that they would need to go to the hospital, and always best to alert both the EMS hospital and the health department when recommending to your patients that, that's the appropriate course of action. There is no vaccine for this condition yet. We've been advised by CDC and by Anthony Fauci that it will be a year to 18 months before we see a vaccine. So that's our best guidance in that regard. So in terms of what you can do in your offices, it's very important to encourage your patients and those who are doing the phone management in your offices to instruct patients that they should call ahead, and if they're coming in for a respiratory-related condition, they should have a mask, they should be going to a designated room, and they should be triaged quickly out of waiting areas. The room should be a room with a closed door that is well ventilated as possible. Some practices I'm aware of already are doing outdoor screening, and that is acceptable.
it should be done in a safe way for patients, and should be done in a way that doesn't disrupt other activities in the neighborhood or other things that are going on. So that should be done in a coordinated fashion. When rooming patients, staff should make as little contact as possible, particularly with patients who are suspected of having coronavirus disease. Importantly, cleaning and hygiene for those rooms, and in general for all rooms, should be done at an aggressive level now. We do recommend, and this has been recommended from the beginning of this outbreak, that wherever possible, you should provide remote care and monitoring for your patients, particularly those high-risk patients. So this is a setting in which telemedicine is critically, critically important. Either telephonic communications to your patients or telemedicine management of your patients becomes a critically important part of keeping people at home and managing their care at home and keeping them from spreading disease and also from coming at risk of getting additional contagion. For many of our providers, we do have the advantage in this state of having a very well-developed health information exchange, CRISP, and most or all of our providers have electronic medical records. This is a good time to use both of those resources to identify proactively your chronically ill, frail, elderly, those who have diabetes, COPD, end-stage renal disease, and immunocompromised patients, to proactively reach out to them to the extent you can with these instructions. Also, you can use your clinical intuition. I'm certain you all have an idea of which of your patients are most at risk and should identify them early. Many of the practices in the primary care practices in the primary care program have a tool called the Prevent Avoidable Hospitalization Tool, which will selectively identify those individuals who would be liable for going unnecessarily to the hospital or to urgent cares or the emergency department. And that tool can be used in this context quite well. And those who have care teams, this is certainly a time to aggressively engage the care teams in these specifically focused efforts. Your communications to all patients should be call ahead, particularly to high-risk patients. We will be posting on our websites in the state some templates that can be used for consistent messaging. There are a number of health departments have done posted similar templates. You feel free to use those that are state branded, or take the state brand off and create them independently. But this would be a very good time to create consistent messaging to all patients. And again, telephonic and telemedicine are very, very important in this setting. Medicare has relaxed their restrictions on telemedicine during this time. And previously it was restricted to rural areas, and they've eliminated that restriction. Medicaid has recently expanded their coverage in regard to this outbreak, and Medicaid will now will also compensate for telemedicine directly to homes. And commercial insurers for the last several years have been under a state statute that requires them to compensate for telemedicine at the same level that they compensate for face-to-face visits. We will be posting with MedKai also some guidance on the billing and coding for updates on that. So testing, again, focusing on testing, most important thing is selecting the right candidates. I would advise you to continually look at the CDC guidelines and what's posted on the Department of Health in terms of the guidance for testing. Also, we want to keep you updated on the guidance for what is adequate personal protective equipment for those individuals who are doing testing. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to make sure that those individuals use the appropriate personal protective equipment, which at this time is eye protection, a mask, and the guidance from CDC has relaxed that from an N95 to a surgical mask, and gown and gloves. They should also properly don that equipment, properly doff that equipment, and appropriately dispose of the equipment. If you're not able, your staff is not able to do that safely, please don't take a risk with doing something that might inadvertently contaminate staff. The negative consequences for that would be far-reaching. Collecting the samples now, the current guideline is a single sample, nasopharyngeal sample, that it should be collected appropriately, and there's guidance on how to appropriately collect the samples that are collected without the appropriate technique tend to not have viral particles and could lead to false negatives. Commercial labs have begun testing, both LabCorp and now Quest, and we're aware of at least one other national commercial lab that's begun doing these tests. Several hospital labs are now also doing the tests. The availability of tests will continue to increase over the next week and weeks, as will the sites where testing can be done. Our state lab also does tests. Those are done only by direction from a local health department. Patients currently who need to be tested need a physician's order. There may be a change in that in the next day or days to come when health departments potentially will become involved for patients who don't have a physician that they relate to, and we'll widen that to allow others outside of the personal physicians to order the tests. Drive-throughs, again, are rapidly being established around the state. We will post those such as they're available on the MDH website. Drive-through testing is done by prescription. The drive-through testing sites will give follow-up instructions to the patients who are attended to there. Among the instructions are to stay at home after the test is done and to follow up with the provider who has written the prescription. Again, most important message I want to give to everyone is that staying current in this situation, but looking at the CDC website, the Department of Health website, local health departments if you choose to, for those who are in the Maryland care program, the Connect site, and we will continue to, from the Department of Health, send out clinician letters that will have details, important details about information as it changes. So I'd like to also just spend a minute before we turn it over to questions on things that we're telling the community at large. The community at large is encouraged to do social distancing. That means keeping at least 3 feet away from others generally and 6 feet away from people who are sick. We all recognize, I've been to the store, I think you all have been out and about today, that is not being adhered to any great extent. We also advise people to avoid touching their face and mouth, to limit face-to-face contact, particularly with individuals who are sick. And if you have a family member who is sick, to stay at home as well as the family member if you're told to do so by the public health officials. This is the voluntary self-isolation. We also tell people, if you're sick, stay at home except for medical care. Separate yourself from other people and from animals. And the message that we've been given to the public, which should be harmonious with your message, is if you're sick, call ahead before seeing your doctor. Wear a face mask if you are sick, particularly if you're coughing. Cover your coughs and sneezes. Don't share your household items. Clean your hands and clean those high-touch surfaces often. So a couple of other things that, in general, we're telling people who are in the workforce, for employers, and people who are working in whatever kind of industry, that routine environmental cleaning is particularly important now, particularly for high-touch surfaces. We're telling employers to communicate open with their employees about COVID-19, particularly to avoid stigma for any staff or customers. And for employees who are traveling, we're telling them to check frequently the CDC traveler health notices. As you, I'm sure, have noticed, this have changed rapidly. And we're telling also employers and employees that if they are not sick, they don't need to wear masks or respirators. It's not recommended to do that. It's not a good prevention technique for people who are not sick. It is used for those who are sick to prevent them from spreading droplets if they're coughing. So I think I will, I think we will end there for, operator, I'll turn it over to you and say that we're ready to field questions.
Thank you, Doctor. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. And we'll take our first question.
Hi, this is Dr. Kalikman. I have actually two questions. One of them, I believe that the illness is much more widespread in the community than the numbers that you're telling us. In my own practice, patients, at least I have 4 or 5 patients with symptoms that are very suggestive of the illness and who were not tested nor can be tested now. So the question is, if they came to the to my office, my staff was exposed to them, we were all exposed to them, what about quarantine that we need to do with the exposure of people who we believe probably do have COVID-19 illness? And my second question is, I just received an email from an orthopedic surgeon from University of Maryland, who is my patient, who has symptoms of COVID-19, started having them last week, was last time at work at the University of Maryland doing surgeries on Friday. So he's asking me, what does he need to do? Where can he get tested? Should he get, if he can't get tested, what should he do with the personnel at and the patients at the University of Maryland? What does he need to let them know? Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. And to your first question, individuals in your staff, we don't recommend that they be self-isolated or self-quarantined unless they have been in contact with a known case of COVID-19 in close contact for a significant duration of time in when they weren't using appropriate PPE. And the reason for that is that we, several fold. One is that we don't want to unnecessarily self-isolate or quarantine significant portions of the healthcare workforce now without good evidence. The second is that in the tests that we've done in the state, the vast majority of them, people who have been tested because they are symptomatic for in a way that we highly suspect COVID-19, the vast majority of them have been negative, and their viral screens have showed other viral infections. So so the likelihood, although there is a possibility that there, as you said, that there are people among us who have COVID-19, I think it's quite likely that there are people who have that. There's also quite likely that there are people who have other conditions that mimic that. So we do rely heavily on the test. The test, again, now will become much more readily available this week. I can't say universally available, but much, much more readily available. And I would, I think we have to stick with that guidance right now in terms of who to isolate. It would be a known contact for a prolonged or reasonable period of time, close contact with a known positive case. As to the physician, I can't give any individual guidance to on any one case, but I would recommend that whether it's a physician or not, that they should contact their personal physician and be led by their clinical judgment in terms of whether they should be tested or isolated or other things. Again, that we want to direct every patient to who has a physician or provider to have their their care and their testing guided as we would in any condition by that provider. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And moving on to our next question.
Yes, Deborah Ali Press. I wanted to know about recommendations regarding co-testing with flu testing. A lot of the smaller practices, we don't have ability to wrap flu test, and if there's any information about options for that.
So thank you for that question. And if you don't have the ability to do flu test, I think it would be something to seek that testing capability if you're going to be evaluating patients for COVID-19 and doing that testing in your office.
We do have the COVID-19 supplies. We did not get the flu supplies, and CEC seems to think that we should co-test.
So if possible, co-test. If you don't, then I think there's no reason to not go ahead and test. But again, the imperative here is do it safely. Please do it safely. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question.
Hi, Gail Anderson from the Eastern Shore. And I'm wondering on the degree of community spread in the state and where and friends are asking and coworkers, and where can we actually get reliable updates as the situation changes? I was reading Fauci's advice, and his advice varies for physicians and communities based on the degree of community spread in an area. And just knowing the state data doesn't help us folks down on the Eastern Shore. That's question one. And then the other question is, do you really want all persons who are 60 and over to go to the ED, even if they have mild symptoms? The letter we got from the MDH this week actually suggested that, but that seems exposing them to undue risk if they have mild symptoms.
Well, thank you. So to answer to both those questions, first one is that the ability to determine community spread is now we know that there is community spread. It's been it's posted on our Maryland Department of Health COVID-19 updates, which are done Monday through Friday. So again, there are 26 cases in the state. I think eight perhaps were community spread, but the majority have been travel related. The community spread has not been noted across the state, so it's been Central Maryland and Southern Maryland for the most part. But that may be a bit misleading in that we haven't been doing widespread sampling across the state. As we do more sampling, we'll have a better understanding of how much community spread there is. So I would use the general guidance that there is community spread, and even if you're in an area, community transmission, I should say, and even if you're in an area that that it's not been noted, I would still give that some consideration. In terms of your second question, individuals who are 60 and over should not absolutely be sent to the emergency department if they have symptoms or even if they have COVID-19 positive tests. If they're otherwise healthy and 60, and they don't have worsening symptoms, they can be monitored at home, either telephonically or through telemedicine. So the messaging there is that individuals 60 and over are those who are more likely to have severe disease and more likely to have lethality. And looking at the data from other countries, from China, from South Korea, and also now recently from Italy, the gradation goes up quite sharply after 70 and then much, much more after 80 in terms of the lethality. So it's a general precaution, but it's not an absolute at age 60.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on to our next question.
Hi. My question is more towards the staff. Our staff is kind of anxious about patients coming into the office and them actually contracting illness. How do you propose we deal with this? Are there any guidelines from the state as to, are we supposed to see patients, not see patients? We've been trying to be proactive by calling patients ahead and telling them not to come into the office if they have any symptoms. But are there any guidelines as to who we should see on an elective basis in an outpatient clinic?
So thank you. That's an excellent question. I think it's one that I think we should all think about in a careful way. Our role in society is to provide care to people who are sick and injured and otherwise in need. And because we have this condition now, this pandemic, doesn't change that role for us. But because of its transmissibility, I think our focus should be on keeping our staff healthy and safe. And the ways that we can assure that to the best degree possible is by doing, as you said, having patients call first and say what kind of condition they have. So certainly there's a whole host of things that we see every day in an ambulatory setting that have no additional risk to our staff. But be able to focus on those individuals who do have fever, cough, respiratory symptoms, and either manage them at home, or if they need to come into the office, or if they happen to show up in the office unannounced, as quickly as possible, put a mask on them, put them in a room with a closed door, have staff do as little contact with them as possible. Doesn't mean that the staff don't need to mask, gown, and glove, but have little contact with them as long as the patient has a mask on. And then do whatever clinical evaluation is appropriate to them. Many will have something that is totally unrelated to COVID-19. But in any case, continuing to do good surface cleaning, good hygiene, instructing staff to do all the same things we tell everybody else, not to touch their face unnecessarily, avoiding the handshakes and washing their hands frequently. And those are the ways that staff can be protected and still provide the care to all of the 6 million Marylanders that we have to provide care to, whether we're in a pandemic or not. But we want to keep the staff healthy so we can get them to work every day, because this will be a time when we'll need more of our providers' efforts and more of our staff efforts rather than less.
Thank you. Can I have a follow-up question too on that? We've been trying to do telemedicine, and is it possible to do something like FaceTime in this time to do telemedicine, or do we have to use an approved EMR?
So that's a very good question, and one that I actually meant to touch on previously. So thank you for asking that question. We are making available to any provider free for 30 days telemedicine solution that's an app. We have a vendor, at least one vendor, who would be willing to provide that to any provider in the state while we're combating this condition. And we'll be posting some information both with MedKai and with the state as to how you can get that app and begin to do telemedicine for your patients. And again, we'll also, as a companion to that, put some information out to talk about appropriate coding and billing and reimbursements for telemedicine, so that it's not, while you're doing that, it's not a dramatic economic loss to practices at the same time.
Can I chime in on that question? I just want to say it's really important that you use a HIPAA-compliant tool. You cannot use FaceTime or non-HIPAA-compliant tools. And if anyone needs help
with telemedicine and doing it appropriately. The vendor that's agreed to do it for 30 days for free is Dr. First, and you can email MedKai. We're agnostic. We'll help you with any vendor you want to use, but you want to pick somebody who is HIPAA compliant. The waivers allow you to use telemedicine at a greater level. It does not waive the responsibility to protect your patient's privacy.
Gene,
sorry about
you
that.
Much. That's, no, no,
the
no,
lawyer
no.
on the call. I just want to protect my guys.
No, absolutely. And HIPAA compliance and complying with the law while we're doing this is also extremely, extremely important. But we will be making those resources available, knowing that that's a preferential way to care for people in this circumstance. Also knowing that not everyone can be cared for by telemedicine, that there will be patients who will need to be seen in your office, or potentially patients who need to be visited in their homes. All of those things are still possible.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And once again, as a reminder, it is star one to press to ask a question at this time. Moving on to our next question.
Oh, hi. My question is, as far as the drive-through places that are being set up, will we receive a list of where they are and how to contact them? And added to that, when you said we need to send an order for patients to be tested, are you referring to the drive-through places? What do you mean by that as far as send an order? Is it going to be electronic? Will they come get a paper order? Just to clarify.
Yeah, so the drive-through testing sites are being rapidly stood up around the state. The details about where they are, what the hours of operation, what kind of prescription or paperwork is required, or whether that can be done electronically, is work and information that we'll be gathering over the next 24 to 48 hours. We will post that information on the Maryland Department of Health website. We'll post it on for our primary care providers on our website, and I'm certain that MedKai will also make that information widely available. And I can tell you that there is a tremendous sense of urgency to establish these sites, and both to be able to do more testing, and also to make sure that we're not forcing or encouraging anyone in an ambulatory setting to do testing when they're not adequately protected in terms of personal protective equipment. So this will be rapidly developing, and we'll put that information up absolutely as soon as it's available. Wish I could give you more detail now, but those details are being written as we speak.
Excellent. And the turnaround time is about 3 days for the results. Is that where we are right now?
Turnaround time, depending on the lab, can be anywhere from a day and a half to 4 or 5 days, depending on the lab. I want to also point out that the actual sampling itself is not the only step that has had challenges in this in the process of testing individuals. There have been supply chain challenges in terms of getting viral media. There have been supply chain issues in terms of test kits themselves, and in terms of equipment to do the test. So all those things are being rapidly ramped up, but there are likely to continue to be some bumps in the road before we get this perfect. So I don't want to overpromise anything to anyone, except to say that everyone available to make this happen as quickly as possible is fully engaged in doing that, and we will make every attempt to make it also as simple as possible and provide as much continuity and information to our providers as possible during this process.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll take our next question.
Yes, this is Fred Sauerberger from Southern Maryland. I have a question about the possibility of false negatives with testing. I understand with the 2 to 14-day incubation period and the test is for an IgG or an IgM response, at what point after inoculation is the patient positive, and what are the chances of a false negative?
Dr. Sauerberger, thank you for the question. First, just the technical answer is that this is not a serologic test. This is a viral protein test, so it's not an IgG-IgM test. And so it becomes positive as soon as we can identify viral particles in the sample. Some samples are not perfect. We know that sampling, particularly oropharyngeal sampling, has been relatively inaccurate. So the CDC has recently recommended just doing nasopharyngeal. Nasopharyngeal sampling, unless there's the appropriate technique used, and you can again refer you to CDC for the technique, it can produce just on the sampling basis a false negative. And beyond that, there are also false negatives because of the number of viral targets that need to be identified to cause a positive. So false negatives will occur, but they appear to be relatively small in number. And of course, it's similar to any test which would have false negatives. I am not the expert in this, but I've not seen any cases where there are false positives. Thank you.
Moving on to our next question.
Hi, I work in an outpatient substance abuse setting, and we have patients in two levels of care, those who are in the community, in other words, intensive outpatient, and those who are in partial hospitalization. Those patients typically are residing in the same home. Typically, these patients are young. If one of the patients becomes symptomatic, we're not necessarily sending them to the emergency room. However, what do we do with the rest of the patients who reside in that home?
So thank you for the question. I would say for those in congregate living, there are, again, guidelines for congregate living that we've posted. But for this particular setting, my suggestion is that they should contact whoever, if the patient becomes symptomatic, contact their care provider or whoever is responsible for their care, and allow them to make a clinical decision about whether or not they should be tested. But in general, I would say in that sort of setting, maintaining to the extent you can social isolation, using good hygiene, and if that individual can be symptomatic individuals who you suspect or the provider suspects of having COVID-19 should be isolated from the other individuals in a congregate setting. So,
okay. I wanted to thank MedCAI for making this opportunity open to all of us, first of all.
Thank you, sir.
Moving on to our next question.
This is Don Bembo calling from Florida, where the state is totally closed down. I have two questions. First is, given an individual who tests positive, how long does that individual have to stay in isolation before they can come back into their communities? And given the individual has minimal symptoms and recovers, what is their time frame for entering the general population? And the second question is a curiosity I've had regarding SARS and MERS and swine flu and Ebola. They all seem to have a finite period of time when they burn out. Is this related to a herd phenomenon in which enough people develop the disease so that eventually everyone is protected?
But to your first question, the isolation period is 14 days or 72 hours after no longer symptomatic. To the second question, I think that story is going to be written yet. Each of these viruses have had a different life cycle. As you know, MERS has not disappeared. MERS continues to exist, particularly in Egypt and other places. SARS tended to disappear, but other coronaviruses have had an epidemiologic path similar to the flu, where they have seasonal recurrences around the world. So I don't think even the boldest epidemiologist has placed any indelible bets on what this one will do. I think we're all hoping for the best, but preparing for whatever comes.
Thank you.
Welcome.
And we'll move on to our next question.
Yes, doctor. I would like to know if a patient was infected, if it's possible that he could be reinfected again, and what kind of precautions do we have to have with the patient after recovery? Could they also develop secondary illnesses like sinusitis or mild bronchitis? I'm not talking about the pneumonia cases. I'm talking about mild cases and what kind of precautions we need.
So, excellent questions. Thank you very much. To the second question, there's people certainly will be likely or able to develop secondary infections after coronavirus. It doesn't provide any protection against other infections. To the first question, we do know that people develop IgM initially, immunity or antibody response to this within 7 days, more or less, and then IgG develops subsequently. But we don't know whether or not that is going to be a protective IgG. So until we start seeing patients who are re-exposed, we won't have an answer to that question. But we do know that there is the typical immunologic response with IgM followed by IgG. We do know that it appears that the lower the IgG response in the infection, the more likely the individual will have severe pulmonary compromise.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. We'll take our next caller.
Hello? Yeah.
Yes.
My name... Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Sharif from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. What I would like to ask is the fact that there are 330 plus million people in this country. The number of people that have been affected, we do not know because we do not have adequate testing. But we do know the number of people that have died. So on the basis of that, and on the basis of the fact that in China, the disease is getting better. In Korea, the disease is getting better. Don't you think that that is what should be conveyed to the people of this country so that they do not panic as much?
So it's hard to predict what the course is going to be here in this country. There were in China a significant number of deaths, as you know, and in Italy, we see now a relatively devastating effect of the pandemic there. Again, I think we hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst. And we consistently message this is not a time for panic. This is a time to do those appropriate mitigation things that the steps that the governor has taken to avoid people coming together in large crowds, to protect the elderly in nursing homes and in hospitals, and other things that are appropriate. Those mitigation efforts are not meant to engender panic, although it's hard to separate those two things. When you take major steps such as been taken globally, in response to this pandemic, it's hard not to have a very high level of concern among people. I don't have a good way. I don't welcome anyone's thought about on a population base how to avoid that. But I think the thing we need to focus on, what we as providers need to communicate to our patients and those we serve, is that this isn't a time to panic. This is simply a time for us to do those things that we know are effective, they're evidence-based methods to mitigate the spread of disease. And for the most part, they're simple things. But the public response will be what the public response is. In many ways, I wish the public response, rather than having a high degree of anxiety, was would be to do a high degree of social isolation. That would be much more effective than anxiety. But again, it's up to us to convey that to our patients.
But one has to accept the facts, what is going on. What one has to learn from what happened in China. One has to learn from what happened in Korea. And this and all that information, this does not seem to be a killer virus, you know. Had it been a killer virus, a lot more deaths would have occurred in the United States. It does not matter how many people were infected. We do know how many deaths have occurred. And you know, every death is one death too much, you know. But there have not been that many deaths, you know. So it is not does not seem to be a killer virus. But you know, and that should be communicated to the community, see, so they understand.
I do have to give you what the scientific evidence that's available is, and that's again from the CDC and from NIH, and that indications are that it's 10 times more lethal than the flu virus. The flu virus kills some 30 or 40,000 people a year in this country. So it is what we would call a killer virus, and we should have great respect for it in that regard. I have a colleague who is in Italy that I spoke to earlier today, and what he describes is overwhelming, both in the impact, the death rate, and the effect that it's having on, particularly in northeastern Italy. So I would have to say that categorically this is a serious viral infection that has a significant degree of lethality, and we shouldn't panic, but we should we need to treat both our patients and the situation with an appropriate degree of concern. Thank you.
Moving on to our next question.
Hi, this is Dr. Adams, and I had a question about the waiver and the letter from Secretary Neal. I understand that we can do telehealth to people at their home, but from what I can tell, they still need, you know, the equipment that meets these video technological standards for medical assistance, and I don't know what the status is with other insurance.
Thank you for that question. And the patients in their homes can use, you know, their tablets or iPhones, their computers, for the their smartphones for the receiving portion of that. The providers need to use HIPAA compliant technology. And I think we, as we highlighted to the previous caller, we're going to be making that technology available, compliant, that providers can use as an app during this this outbreak on a temporarily free basis from at least one vendor, and we anticipate there may be other vendors who will be willing to do so. So I think we'll be able to assist in that way to make that more readily available to providers if they choose to use telemedicine. And again, the environment has at least temporarily changed, both Medicare, Medicaid, and has already been conducive in commercial payers for the most part to compensate for those services.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Moving on to our next question.
Yes, hi. I'm a gastroenterologist, and I perform procedures, and the question I have is if either me or one of my staff, I'm in a small practice, if me or my staff contract, God forbid, the virus, and what is our responsibility and what is the responsibility of the county or the public health in terms of follow-up and the tracking those patients? So we obviously will be having all the demographics, but in terms of reaching out and communication, and what is my role and what's the role of the public health? And the second question I have is, I go to one of the hospitals where there is a confirmed case of the infection, and I've not had a direct contact with the patient, and the patient is being quarantined. And if I'm doing procedures in an outpatient setting, should I tell the patients up front that I have been in this hospital where there is a patient, and just the background to be proactive?
So if I understand the question, and if I don't get it right, let me know. You're saying if you test positive for coronavirus, what responsibility do you, what actions should you take? And then what actions would public health take regarding patients that you've come in contact with? So it would generally be if you had symptoms, you would contact your physician if you had an appropriate test, depending on if it's positive, you would be told either to isolate at home, or depending on age and other conditions and your symptoms, you might be told to go to a hospital. Your patients would be advised that presumably they've come in contact with someone who was positive for the coronavirus. And that could be through public health, or it could be through through the work of your office. I would say as the epidemic ramps up, it will become really probably nearly impossible for public health officials. It will become impossible for public health officials to do contact tracing. So to say, each individual has this, let's talk to all the people who also came in contact with them. It would be more the latter of letting patients know that a provider that you saw had COVID-19. If you were in close contact with them for a prolonged period of time, then if you have symptoms, you should let your provider know. And if you have symptoms, particularly, you should let your provider know. If you don't have symptoms, you ought to self-isolate. So that would be that would probably be the scenario. Many times there are other mitigating circumstances, there are other conditions that might, depending on the nature of the contacts, that might either make that more relevant or less. So, and these are hypotheticals, but if your patients are all patients with end-stage renal disease, that obviously would have a greater impact than if your patients were all pediatric patients, for instance, because of the higher likelihood of those patients getting significant disease than patients who are in a pediatric practice. And I can't give you a categorical answer for every situation, so I would say, in general, we would do the same things that we would do ordinarily with contact management, except for depending on the particular circumstance. And the nuances of that are probably best decided in concert with the local health department. Is that helpful?
Yes. And the reason I asked was there was this situation where a physician from Australia, she visited the U.S. and returned to Australia. She had some vague symptoms, and subsequently she tested positive. And meanwhile, between the time that she tested positive and was back in Australia, she had seen about 70 patients in Melbourne, and it has become a huge issue there. So if down the road, God forbid, me or my staff have it, other than letting the patients know that we contracted, are there any consequences that we should anticipate?
No, letting patients know whoever it was proved positive for coronavirus, and individuals who were in close contact with them, it's good to alert them, and they know that they can self-isolate themselves. And that it would be that's one of the ways that we can help reduce the spread of the disease. And most of those patients will probably have no consequence, but it's good to have them alerted to that fact.
Dr. Happ, let me chime in on this one too, because I think you're also referring to potential liability, legal or otherwise, Board of Physicians with regards to this. I think the key and the first thing to remember is I would strongly urge all of you to go to the Department of Health's website, and they give guidance for employers and for others on what you do with regards to this. And if you act under their guidance and you act as a reasonable practitioner, it puts you in a better position. The second thing I would suggest is if you have concerns or questions about your risk, that you reach out, and I'm happy to have anybody, regardless of whether you use the MedHigh insurance agency or not, you can talk to them, or you should call your insurance agency, your malpractice broker, or if you're in a hospital setting, the risk department, and just say, what guidance do you have for me? Is my coverage appropriate? Just to make sure that you're set up in a way where if you're concerned about some type of problem. But again, the key is that if you act in a reasonable, prudent way, and if you follow the guidance that the state gives you, you're generally going to be okay. But it's always prudent to check and make sure that you have the appropriate insurance coverage and that you've talked to professionals to put yourself in the best position. Because after this is all over, I'm sure there will be a lot of people looking at what you did and how you did it if there's a bad outcome.
Yeah, and if I'm going to a hospital if I'm going to a hospital where there is a case of confirmed coronavirus, and before this is after my hospital, I'm not in direct contact with the patient, and should I tell the patients I see in the office, my regular outpatients, that I've been in so-and-so hospital where there is this patient and whatever the story is, and is it something that is expected of, or can I not say that?
I wouldn't advise that if you're not at, I think virtually all of our hospitals will soon have patients who have coronavirus, and I don't think that if you haven't been in contact with the patient themselves, I don't think you have any obligation to say that you're just in a facility that had someone with coronavirus. It's not current guidance. That is not the current guidance.
And the question that you just asked me, I would suggest that you call your hospital risk management department and ask them how they would like you to handle it. And again, I would also suggest that anybody who has concerns like this, that's the kind of thing that I'm happy to have you reach out to MedHigh, and we'll do our best to get you the best person to answer, depending on whether you work in an employed setting or you're in private practice. A lot of times the appropriate answer might be a little different, but generally you want to follow whatever the professional guidelines are from the Department of Health, and you want to act like a reasonable, prudent, responsible physician. But again, something as specific as you just outlined, I really think it's worth a call to your hospital's risk management department.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's quite useful. I appreciate your service. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question.
Yes, hi. I was wondering what your recommendations would be for families with family members who have recently taken flights in the last few weeks and up till today. For example, there's a lot of college students that have gone on their spring breaks and now are coming back home as opposed to going back to their schools. So it is unknown whether or not they've been in contact with people who have the coronavirus.
Thank you for the question. In terms of clinical guidance for that, it's if you're not in contact with a known case of a laboratory-proven coronavirus, then taking the usual precautions in terms of hand washing and other things that it would do for the general public. Just the fact of traveling on an airplane, although I think it's possibly riskier at this time, is not something that we are compelling people to self-isolate. Now, if there are countries that if they're traveling from overseas, they or came off of a cruise ship or other kinds of particular circumstances that are particularly high risk, that might be a different circumstance. But just domestic travel on an airplane is treated just as anyone else would be.
Wonderful. Now, so that's college students, but then if we're talking about over the age of 80 and they're away, and they're going to domestically travel back here to Maryland. Would you recommend they stay put, like, let's say they're in Florida and they wanted to come back to Maryland? Would you suggest that they just stay in Florida, even though they really want to come back to Maryland, if they're over the age of 80?
Thank you. So that's an excellent question. And people over the age of 80 should not be traveling now unless it's absolutely essential. They should be limiting their contact. They're extraordinarily higher risk for the worst outcomes from this condition. So the best advice is for those individuals is that they should really limit their contacts in general. They should have their contacts with their healthcare providers to the extent possible by telemedicine, so they don't need to come into offices. They should have plenty of large supply of medications, so they don't have to run out to the pharmacy. If they have caregivers, their caregivers should be doing appropriate hygiene, hand washing before they come in, before they deliver care for in-home caregivers. And generally, for this period of time, until this pandemic washes through, they should be very cautious. And included in that would be air travel, yes.
Would you recommend if they live, for example, so many of these people live in apartment buildings, should they be quarantined, you know, just staying in their apartments or going outside with gloves, pushing the elevator buttons, for example, and then going outside? Or would you recommend they just stay cooped up in their apartments?
You know, I don't think that we're at the have to stay in your apartment, but if they're going outside, social distancing is a good idea, you know, avoiding crowds and those kinds of things.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we'll take our next question.
Good evening. This is Dr. Dawn Carroll. I have just a couple of questions and concerns. Very early in your presentation, you mentioned that there doesn't seem to be any racial disparity in terms of morbidity and mortality associated with COVID-19. And I'm just curious as to the number of people in this country as well as in Europe, how many of those folks were of African-American or Latino descent? That's one. My second question is, I'm a little concerned about the narrow scope of who is considered to be appropriate for testing, particularly because we know that in young people, they can develop a mild illness and still keep right on going. And if we're not identifying these young people with mild illness who are out in the community, they have the potential to go out and spread to other people. And my third question is, you mentioned a lot about people going to their primary care physicians or accessing their PCP with questions or concerns, but what about the segment of the population that do not have PCPs? What's in place for them, specifically when we start the drive-through testing and people require an order? If patients do not have a PCP, how are they to be able to access screening and testing? That's it, my three questions.
Great. So I hope I can remember all three of them. The first question was
really... Well, the
first
one had to do with race and racial disparities.
Yeah, I think that the intention for that comment was that it can affect any race or ethnicity, and it's particularly the language is used in that regard to avoid stigmatization. So we don't want to stigmatize any particular race and say this is comes from X, Y, and Z. That's all. And there may very well in the end be some higher prevalences in certain ethnic groups, but there is no protection that's afforded by any race or ethnicity. But it is truly a global pandemic. To the testing and not testing everyone, certainly if there was an easy, safe way to test everyone, it may be preferable. The fact of the matter is we do have limitations in testing, so we test based on those limitations. knowing that they will come a point in most epidemics where testing really doesn't add, you know, when it's very widespread, it adds some additional information, but it's not overwhelming. I think at the point we are now, we need to do more testing to see what the general impact in the community is, and to do more appropriate isolation and those kinds of things. But we can't test everyone. There's not enough resources, not enough providers, not enough kits. And that may change over time, but currently that's where we are. I advise everyone to continue to monitor the CDC and the department's websites, and that's the best indicator of how the testing will change over time. And the third point that you made was
access to care for patients that do not have primary care.
Yes. So, in those individuals who need to get tested, who don't have a primary care or a provider that they can have write a prescription, I believe that, and this is not anything that is done yet, but I believe that the local health departments will be providing that resource, so that local health department staff, whether they're nurses or others, will serve as a surrogate. I hope that's helpful.
And we'll take our next question.
Yeah, hi, I'm Scott Poulton. I'm a primary care in Catonsville, Maryland. I have a couple questions, so I'll go one at a time just to make it easier. The first is supplies. I mean, we're basically having to mask anybody who comes in the door with any respiratory symptoms. I am testing. I do have an N95 mask, unfortunately, I'm reusing. I do have a face shield. I think we're doing everything appropriately, but I don't think most primary cares are testing. I cannot continue testing unless I have masks to pull on people when they come in the door. I'm running out of those. And on top of that, when I run out of those, what I'm going to do for people who have respiratory symptoms, because I believe I can't see them anymore. Would that be true?
So we are aggressively seeking more personal protective equipment for the state overall, and so are other states from the Strategic National Stockpile and from other places, and for ramping up those that produce those supplies. I have to tell you, do what you can do now, but maintaining safety for yourself and your staff in terms of testing. For the general patients who come in with respiratory symptoms, who are coughing, using simple surgical masks is all that you need to do. And I think that those
are relatively available. We cannot get them. I've inquired from my McKesson rep. I inquired with the state health department. Their comment from the state health department was, we can't get them from our own personnel. How do you expect them to get us for you?
So I thank you very much for that, and I will certainly escalate that. We have a daily call with the individuals who are procuring as much as possible.
But you would agree if I don't have masks and call me and they have symptoms, I cannot see them. Would you agree with that?
I would say if you have a patient who is coughing and you suspect that they may have coronavirus disease, it's so much better to care for them remotely than bring them into the office. That's right.
That leads into my next question. I'm hearing a variety of things. There's a gentleman, I think, Michael Olsterholm, who, to be honest with you, I'd recommend looking at his posts on YouTube and other things. I think he's very informative. He is saying that there was a period of time for probably a couple of days where people are very infectious without symptoms, and that kids – under age 18, 2.2% of the people in China, the kids under age 18 had symptoms. So that leaves almost 98% of the children. So in a pediatric practice, they're going to have people coming in without symptoms who are infectious. What do we do in those situations?
So I think what you're describing is the nature of a pandemic, is that there are people who will be asymptomatic, who potentially could be spreading virus. This is, you know, what we see with flu, what we see with measles, what we see with other, you know, highly contagious infectious diseases. And I think we do exactly what we said we were going to do, encouraging social isolation for those individuals who we identify as high risk, to more interventions in terms of telemedicine and those sorts of things to the extent that we can.
Yeah, I understand.
Use those supplies. I wish I could tell you we have supply. I have a warehouse of supplies that I could provide to you, but I don't. So I think we're all in the same circumstance in terms of
But my question is, so what about the pediatric? So this is gonna, from what I've seen from people who are informative in this situation, this is going to ramp up, and we're trying to push down the hump, not prevent it from happening, because we can't, if I'm not mistaken. So when we're over when the hump is getting, if we're where Italy is in a week, as primary care providers, when a lot of the people coming in to see us are going to have the disease but not have symptoms, and we don't have masks, are we just going to telemedicine?
No, I don't think so. I think that you maximize that where it's appropriate. But for individuals who are coming in for other conditions, or people who are not coughing, don't need to have masks.
Except for we're gonna have a population where there's gonna be a lot of people who have the disease and it's early and aren't symptomatic. Am I missing that?
So people, in general, the guidance is that people spread this disease through sneezing and coughing and droplets.
Actually, University of Minnesota, he says that for 2 days you will have people spread the disease by just breathing.
So that's different from our guidance. So I wish I could help you with a better answer. And my best advice is for all of us to follow the best advice that we get is from the Center for Disease Control. We tend to stay in lockstep with that for the Department of Health. And during any of these episodes that I've been witness to in the past, we see a large range of different kinds of guidance that come from other sources. It's always been best to just pick your true north, whatever that is, and stick to that.
The governor of Ohio had five reported cases, and they think there are 100,000 people affected. Are we feeling that way in Maryland?
I actually honestly can't give you an estimate of how many people we think are affected. I think the NIH, the Center for Disease Control, speculates, as I think that we've widely seen those graphs, that there will be an increase in the country. What that increase will be is difficult, impossible to predict. But clearly, by doing the things that we're doing now in terms of mitigation efforts, that's the best evidence-based practices to reduce that spread and to preserve lives and to avoid particularly impacting those who are most vulnerable. I think that's what we should be doing right now. And I thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Moving on to our next question. Hearing no response, we'll move on to our next question.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Dr. Daljeet Saluja from Baltimore, Maryland. First of all, Dean and Dr. Haff, thank you so much for this informative hour and a half. I think it really shed light on a lot of very critical points, and I appreciate MedTie doing this for us. I have two questions. My first question is, as Dean knows and Dr. Haff knows, I'm in Baltimore City, and I have a very large Medicare patient population with chronic diseases, which are our high-risk patients. Unfortunately, most of our patients in Baltimore City do not have access to internet at home, smartphones, tablets, et cetera. They do have telephones.
are we going to expand in the state of Maryland telemedicine and include telephonic conversations for that, so we are able to keep our practices open and build these patients and try to avoid them from coming into the office for exposure?
Thank you for the question. And at least a simple answer, but it's not going to be a complete answer, is that Medicare does currently, as of this year, pay for telephonic consultations. So it's a way to at least mitigate that financial impact and be able to communicate with patients that way and within the Medicare guidelines. Medicaid and commercial payers do not compensate for that, to my knowledge. So that's a bit of an answer, but I think whatever health the department can give you and whatever assistance we can give you in terms of the guidelines and care for those patients or potentially accessing, for those that do have tablets or smartphones to access telemedicine, we're more than happy to help. And I know you serve a very challenging population, as most of our providers do, and I think it's going to be a challenge for all of us over the next several weeks and maybe longer in dealing with this. So please be assured that MedCAI and the Maryland Department of Health and the governor and all of the state agencies are going to do everything we can do to support this. There will be things that we can't do just simply because of supplies or other things, but anything I'm sure that the governor could do to mitigate this, he will be more than willing to do.
Perhaps, Dr. Hatch, at the MD.